You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Stephen Dixon. He's the author most recently of a novel, Interstate. His publisher, Holt, has also published his collected stories, the stories of Stephen Dixon, and his previous novel, Frog, was a nominee for the National Book Award. He's written, I think, around 17 books, and this is an American trajectory. Almost every small press and every literary magazine that I've ever looked at has published stories by Stephen Dixon. And, you know, it's a very interesting thing to watch, because often you suspect that America doesn't provide the springboard that will bring a writer to wider notice after a certain number of books. You certainly assume that a writer may be just condemned to the world of the small press and the literary magazine. I wondered, has your life, your writing life, altered by this new circumstance?
No. I mean, other than that I'm on a book tour for a book which no other publisher was able to give to me, I'm still writing the same way whenever I find the time to.
I sense that the technique of your writing, long paragraphs, long lines, has always been there from the beginning. No?
No. I started off as a naturalistic, realistic writer with short sentences in the Hemingway-esque mode, and that's because I was teaching myself how to write. And if I felt that if I was teaching myself how to write, I would have to do it with short sentences and quick dialogue. And then from that, I learned how to write longer sentences, because in the beginning, my weakness was narrative, and my strength, which I think is the only gift that a writer has, was dialogue. And so I had to learn how to write sentences, which I didn't know how to do. But I knew how to write dialogue. All I did was listen.
It seems that at a certain point there must have been a collision with Samuel Beckett. Was he an important writer to you?
More so in a couple of the short plays and some short stories. But no, by the time that I started reading Samuel Beckett, I didn't have any influences whatsoever. I never really could read the novels of Samuel Beckett. They might be great, but they're a little cold for me, although sometimes very funny. The influence that Beckett has for me more than anything else is the same kind of influence that Joyce has, and that's the kind of life that they led, a life of integrity and a life of never selling out in their writing, not once. And that's what kind of influence. That's the kind of influence that I also use from a writer.
Who then, once you went past Hemingway?
Joyce. And you see, I had to shuck the influence of Hemingway, because my stories were sounding like Hemingway stories, but like bad Hemingway stories. And so I discovered Joyce, and I began writing in a stream of consciousness style. And I realized that this was absurd, because it would be easily detected that I was very much influenced by Joyce. And so I had to shuck that style. Other than those two, I can't think of myself as being influenced by anybody. And that was very early on when I was in my 20s. Now I'm in my late 50s. I was influenced by the content of Dostoevsky when I read those in my teens, and I read them in my 20s, and I was influenced by the strength, by the blood, you know, the gore, the very strong emotional content of the stories. So I was influenced by the subject matter more so than, of course, by the style of Dostoevsky, since it was a translation.
In Interstate, this novel essentially begins 8 times, and it tells the story essentially of a father and his relationship to being a father and to his children. What happens melodramatically in the present tense, in a future past tense, is that on the interstate, two goons in a van drive up. They behave in a threatening and perhaps dangerous manner, and in at least several of the versions, take out a gun and kill one of the two girls. But the book is about projected emotions and dread and feelings of flooding and kind of hemorrhaging love. And I wondered how you started on this and what brought it through 8 enactments.
Well, I wanted the emotional experience to be complete from every possible way. I mean, I tell it in the first person, I tell it in the second person, I tell it in the third person in different chapters. I tell it in the past tense, the future tense, I tell it in the present tense. I tell it from every perspective. I change the father in some scenes, in some chapters. I mean, he's a different, he has a different, if one, you know, looks at it closely, he has a different profession. He's a dental technician in the beginning, and then later on he's an office worker, as if he's made up of many, many different men. I'm just, what I try to do is tell it so completely from every perspective that the reader would feel the story as if he had lived it himself. And I felt that that was the only way. Also, I'm a stylist, and I like to tell stories differently than other writers. And I felt this was not only a different way, but a way that fit in with the idea that I had of telling sort of a multi, and, you know, interpretable story of the same event.
The section that reduced me to a pulp, I'm afraid, is the one in which having harangued both inside his head and outside to prevent a hospital worker from telling him that his daughter is dead, he goes to the bathroom, takes a piss, and thinks, this is the first time I've done this since my daughter died. And then there follows a cadenza of pages in which every event is the first event, the first meal, the first return home, and then the meal after that. And it seems that an almost unbearable act of compassion is required from the writer, as well, of course, as from the reader. There's no easy attempt here to make this ferociously funny or ferociously warm. This isn't a particularly nice man. But what does writing like this do to you?
It had the same effect on me in writing it. I mean, it reduced me to a pulp. But I thought it was worth it because I really wanted to get as deep emotionally in a character, in a situation, as I had ever gotten before with anything that I had ever done. And I admit many times, and thinking about it now, I feel as sad almost as I did then. Where I would get up and cry. I'd walk over to my wife and tell her that I don't know if I could go on with this thing. But, no, I would. I'd take a walk and come back.
I'm speaking to Stephen Dixon, and his newest novel is Interstate. Now, when I'd been reading you before, there was the feeling that many of these things had begun as improvisations, as spiels, as kind of routines.
You mean other stories?
The stories, things that had won the Aga Khan Prize for Humor in the Paris Review. Almost as if one's father were to get up behind the microphone at a nightclub and begin to talk about his life as if it were somehow possible for him to speak in a sort of Lenny Bruce routine mm-hmm. about daily life. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be very much an origin point, a certain kind of stand-up comedy that by now here has gone to a very opposite pole.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't want, you know, the listener to think that, you know, the book is entirely tragic. I mean, there are some, I think, funny parts in the book and some warm parts and some real good exchanges between the father and the daughter, either memories or things that might even take place in the present, like the possibility of the last chapter. I don't want to give away the novel. Because what the intention of the book was to make the family and the relationship between the father and the daughter so real that the reader would feel the same loss if such a loss did exist, or feel the imagined loss if it's just imagined. So it's not – I mean, the book isn't 374 pages of just sadness and tragedy and stuff that will make you weep.
Well, but the one thing the book doesn't do is the one thing that's become expectable now.
In me?
In writing in general, yeah. when you think, say, of J.D. Ballard's novel Crash or books in which suffering becomes the subject for festivity, this book avoids any kind of easy treatment of the mm-hmm. subject mm-hmm. as fashionable black humor. In fact, if anything, it's the past before the narrator, Nathaniel Frey, has a family, particularly a hugely comic girlfriend.
Yeah.
But it seems as if the time for comedy was before he got married. Mm-hmm. Now that he has children, he can do, in the guise of tenderness, little stories and charming personal baby talks to mm-hmm. his daughter and to his wife. But the world of harsh laughter has mm-hmm. been left behind here.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I'm losing my sense of humor. My daughters don't think so. In fact, they complain that I make too many jokes. But you're talking about the book and not my personal life. It's true. Somebody said, you know, Dixon, you were once a funnier writer. And I almost took that as an insult, except I realized the origins of the book. And that was to write a very deep, emotional story. And so I took the deepest, most emotional, you know, event that could possibly happen, the loss of a daughter. And I couldn't fool around too much with it. It just wasn't much room for humor. Now, in my students' writing, you know, they'll take the Holocaust and make a joke out of it sometimes. And I tell them, you can't do this. There are certain subjects that are off limits for humor. And one of them is the Holocaust, that's for sure. And one of them is the death of a child. And there are many others. And so I just had to hold back. I mean, it didn't take any effort on my part to restrain myself in not being humorous, you know, because I don't need that kind of restraint not to be humorous in a certain situation.
I'm very moved by what you said earlier about wanting to lead, as Joyce did and Beckett did, a life of artistic integrity, about never selling out in any of the writing. And just the other day I was talking to a writer who distressed me by saying that he didn't know whether he'd always be writing novels. He might be writing screenplays, and you know, and there was just a kind of giddy eagerness mm-hmm. to go wherever the main mm-hmm. chance might mm-hmm. be. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me to be more and more the American literary scene. I wonder how you survive in its midst.
Well, listen, writing is the thing I love to do most, so why screw it up? You know, when I was a very young writer in 1968, Playboy took a story and they loved it till the last paragraph, and they changed it and they wouldn't take it unless I took their changes, and I did everything I possibly could, and they still wouldn't do anything they needed, that last Playboy ending. And so I let them. I was an absolutely broke man, and they were paying $2,000. They gave me another $1,000. They gave me an invitation to the Playboy Club, which I never took, and a pair of cufflinks for French cuffs, which, of course, I didn't wear. But I was really distraught. And 2 weeks before the issue was – I was so naive, I thought I could stop the issue from coming out. And I told my agent, you know, take it back. I don't want it. I don't want them to publish something, even if it's a paragraph that I didn't write and that is cheap, meretricious, and crap. And she said, don't be ridiculous. You know, they won't take any other stories. And anyway, I let it go, and I told myself that was the last time I would ever do that, because I knew that if I went off the track once more, if I let an editor or an agent or somebody dictate my writing life, that I would be a dishonest writer, and I would give up the one thing that I love to do. And so I've been asked lots of times, and sometimes in stories, editors of well-known magazines have said, if you do this and that, we'll take it. I say, I'm sorry, I don't agree with it. I mean, if it was good advice, I would agree with it. But it was bad advice. It would cheapen the story. And so I've never done it. I've never done it again. And I think this is one of the reasons that I've never had a block. I've never been able not to write because I've always written what I wanted to write, and I don't care about the consequences. I'm not interested in money. Henry Holt, and I tell them now if they're listening, they don't have to pay me for my books. I mean, they could, if they want to publish them, you know, fine. If they don't want to publish them, they don't have to do that either, because I'm not interested in money. I'm not interested even in being published. I mean, it's nice to be published, but the best thing is to write. And if anything stops, you know, comes in the way between me and my writing, I say kiss off, you know, because this is the only thing that gives me pleasure, you know, that isn't the kind of pleasure of my wife and my children and things like that.
You seem to have made certain decisions, among others, that your writing will not be about nothing.
Right.
I remember a characteristic gesture of a writer I admire. It was Donald Barthelme, who came in to a class and said, write a short story about nothing. And he came in and the following week brought his own story in. It was called Nothing, A Preliminary Account. Mm-hmm. But at a time when most serious American fiction has engaged nothing in one form or another, you seem to have chosen the everyday. And I wondered if you could speak about that.
Well, I mean, writing is story and style to me. I mean, one could be a stylist and be a cold writer. I mean, your style might be brilliant, but your story has very little content and very little emotion. I have to have emotion in my stories, but I also have to have a style that will change from story to story and from novel to novel. To go back to before, I mean, before I was a naturalistic writer with short declarative sentences, and then, you know, it grew into something else only because it was interesting. But you have to have both as a writer. You have to have style and you have to have a story. And if you don't have a story, certainly you're cheating the reader, at least the reader who wants content in his fiction. And if I don't have a style, then I'm maybe not cheating, you know, a certain kind of reader, but I'm cheating some other kind of reader who's interested in advanced styles. But I'm also cheating myself because hurting myself because it won't be interesting for me to write. I create challenges. I purposely create stylistic challenges when I write, so I could overcome them. And I feel I've been able to overcome every single stylistic challenge. You don't see the challenge that I've been able to overcome. But in writing the piece, you know, writing a page 30, 40 times, writing a story 30, 40 times, all of them get written like that. By writing like that, by repeating, you know, the words over and over again till I memorize each page that I write, I've been able to overcome, you know, the stylistic challenges that I've made for myself. That also makes the writing process fun for me, enjoyable, the challenge. Otherwise, it would be repeating myself. And so many writers sort of repeat their styles. I mean, sometimes for commercial reasons, because the public wants, you know, the same kind of story, and the marketeers want the same kind of story, want the same kind of style, and a style that doesn't challenge the reader. Well, my style, in a way, does challenge the reader, but once you pick up on it, you know, you're not challenged anymore. I mean, you begin understanding what I'm doing.
Well, it's interesting because I return to the idea that as you were starting to publish, writing had become more and more pyrotechnical. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the kinds of explosions of information in Pynchon, mm-hmm. or the, you know, mixture of, you know, almost superhuman clarity and poetry of Nabokov. Mm-hmm. But there seemed that there would no longer be, at least during that time, a writer of ordinary speech who would also be a serious writer. Mm-hmm. That was for later.
I'm not interested in teaching people anything in my writing, and certainly not teaching them anything that they could learn in school. I'm interested in creating very real, believable characters with strong emotional content. That's all I'm interested in. You know, Pynchon, even though he's joining my publishing house, he leaves me cold. You know, he might be a master of something, but it's not a master of something that I'm interested in. Most writers leave me cold. Now, Nabokov is a genius, and it comes out in his writing not just in that he is or that he was, you know, an intellectual genius, but he was also a writing genius. I mean, he's a master. There are very few writing masters, but he certainly was one of them. Borges, you know, another modern master.
Well, Borges would be the essence of the writer who leaves most people cold.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know. He didn't leave me cold. I mean, there were some stories that I found were pretty hot.
Where did the signature long paragraph come from?
It just developed. In a way, I like to sort of build on words. And I could only do that in the long paragraph and sometimes in a long sentence. I have some – in Frog, I have a 40-page sentence someplace. But the challenge there was to write it where the reader wouldn't know until it was over or until the reader had to go to the bathroom that he was in – or she was in the middle of a sentence and had been for about 20, 30 pages. It was a challenge, but also it comes from wanting a certain kind of momentum to take place, to sort of grab the reader – or sort of inveigle him in and then hold him with a long sentence or a long paragraph. But where it wouldn't be trying, where it would be accessible and clear, and then the reader would come out of it saying, I was in some sort of place. I don't know where I was, but the guy got me. It's also, this, in the last 10 years, really since I started Frog, and that was in 1985, so that took me 5.5 years. I got involved in the long paragraph in the long sentence, and it came from my other writing. It just sort of gravitated to that. Now, who knows? It might end up, you know, where in 3 years I'll be writing 2- and 3-word sentences. You know, I mean, just to change things around.
Well, it's interesting to me because that paragraph, that sentence, and that cadence mediates for me as a reader between the heartbeat, mm-hmm. and the breath, mm-hmm. and then the rhythm of thought.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting how physiological, on the one hand, the writing can be. As you mm-hmm. say, this is writing that very rapidly enters mm-hmm. your life. Toward the end of Interstate, Nat says that he has failed at telling the truth to his daughters and failed at fibbing and failed at the in-between state as well. Mm-hmm. What is the in-between state between truth and fiction, between a sentence that begins in one place and can go anywhere? Yeah. Where have you been taken as a reader?
A lot of places, and I couldn't say here all the places that I'm taking you. Certainly I'm asking questions like, what is truth? What is imagined? You know, what is the real story here? And does it matter if it didn't happen, if the girl wasn't shot? Does it matter that she was shot? I mean, in one of the interstates, the oldest girl is the one who is injured or killed. The youngest girl survives. What am I saying? What am I trying to do here? I don't want to give it away. You know, I mean, I spent 2 obsessive years, day and night, on this book. I really want the reader to interpret it. As I say, it's a multi-interpretable book. You know, you caught on with what you were saying before in the questions that he asked his daughter, in a sense, could be the questions that I'm asking the reader or suggesting, you know, to the reader. You know, so it's up to the reader to sort of decide. I couldn't say, you know, in the time that we have here.
I was moved by his use of the word failed. I have failed in truth. Does failure interest you?
Sure. Failure and loss are my two big themes. Failure and loss. Everybody fails. Everybody loses. And they should recognize that. And if you recognize that, you have a little more compassion for everybody else. I like the theme of loss better than the theme of success. So many people deal with success. Playboy, in their ending, you know, for that story that they ruined for me, you know, it was a successful ending, you see. That's what they wanted. That's the Playboy ending. That's what the world really likes. Movies where the lovers come together. I think life isn't like that. I don't want to talk about death. There's illness all around. There's horror all around. And I'm trying to deal with it in my fiction. And loss is just a more interesting subject, you know, to deal with. And failure. I mean, I like people who try and fail. I mean, as a writer, of course, there's that metaphor that you're always failing. You're never really doing what you want to do. It's not success in the sense of, oh, I didn't get this prize or that prize. That means nothing. It's that, you know, the attempts that you make in your literature, in your writing, you know, and you get there. I mean, but you don't get there all at once. So I like the subject matter of failure. In my little short collection, Long Made Short, before this book came out, or right after the big collection that Holt did, all 12 stories are about loss, brain loss, loss of father, loss of mother, loss of child. There's a child loss story in that one, loss of job, loss of love. I mean, I love loss as a subject. It's tender, and it can be funny if you laugh at it.
I've been speaking to Stephen Dixon, the author most recently of Interstate, a novel published by Henry Holt. Thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you very much for being here.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Pop.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.